This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, another week, another mass shooting. This time, the target of gun violence was a group of congressional Republicans gathered for a practice before the annual congressional baseball game. Five were wounded, including Louisiana Congressman Steve Scalise, who suffered critical injuries as a result of the shooting. Capitol Police were able to bring down the suspect, but it was yet another shocking example of how prevalent such gun violence has become.
And you know, the shocking news here is also that there have been more than 155 mass shootings across the country in just the past year, Mark. Gun violence is now the third leading cause of death for America's children. Some 33,000 deaths by gun occur in this country every year. We often tend to focus on the mass shootings that grab the headlines, but the problem is much more pervasive than that, Mark. This is a public health emergency.
While the majority of Americans feel we should have stricter gun laws in this country, the policymakers seem to be taking things in the opposite direction. We often see an uptick in lip service to the victims of gun violence after episodes like this, but not enough to engender support for new policy directives that might curb the sale of guns in this country, especially the more deadly assault weapons. But background checks still are not mandatory in all states.
Well, Mark, this most recent incident brought to mind a memorable guest we had on the show in the past year. Dr. Garen Wintemute is an emergency medicine physician and professor at UC Davis. He's also the founder and director of the Violence Prevention Research Institute, where he's been studying the depth and the scope of the gun violence epidemic in this country for more than 20 years, some of the policies that have led to these high numbers and the impact it's had on population health.
We'll also be joined by Lori Robertson, the managing editor of factcheck.org, who's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we love to hear from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Garen Wintemute in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The Republican healthcare bill being crafted behind closed doors in the Senate is starting to see the light of day, being called by one lawmaker on the inside as an iterative process. The American Healthcare Act, which narrowly passed in the House, is under reconstruction in the GOP-controlled Senate. And Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants a vote on the revised bill before the July 4th summer recess. Insiders in the know are seeing a number of measures that are likely to remain, a rollback of the Medicaid expansion, caps on Medicaid grants to states, and loss of essential benefits that are required to be covered by all insurance companies. Also, the loss of protections for older, sicker Americans. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office will have little time to score the Senate version of the bill, and there will not likely be any time for committee input or any input at all from Democrats in the Senate. Many of those on Medicaid are receiving recovery treatment for opioid addiction. Now many are worried about the Republican focus on rolling back Medicaid and the fact that it may destroy their ongoing success with medication-assisted drug treatment, saying they wouldn't be able to afford the monthly drug treatment on their own. As the death toll rises from the opioid addiction crisis, several communities across the country are considering sanctioning legal injection sites for opioid users to shoot up under supervision with clean needles. An estimated 50,000 people died from opioid overdose last year. States like Indiana saw a huge spike in HIV and hepatitis C infections among opioid addicts who were sharing needles, setting them up for a highly costly cure in the case of Hep C, or a lifetime of medication control in the case of HIV. The California legislature is considering a bill that would authorize eight California counties to test so-called safe injection sites. Addiction experts see this as an excellent opportunity to monitor chronic opioid users, reduce their risk of overdose or disease transmission through shared hypodermic needles, and provide a safe interface to lead addicts to treatment. Opponents view this as giving addicts a, quote, green light to continue abusing drugs. Currently, Vancouver, Canada is the only region in North America where such a program has been underway for several years now, and the data are promising for improving outcomes. A study published in The Lancet found that overdose deaths on the streets surrounding Vancouver's safe injection site dropped 35% in the 2 years after it opened. The sponsor of the California bill says the safe injection sites would operate more like medical clinics, ensuring that drug abuse counselors are on hand to offer guidance towards drug treatment options, as well as being armed with naloxone for those who experience an overdose. Lead poisoning of children has gained significant coverage in recent years on the heels of the Flint water crisis, where state officials switched the city's drinking water source and denied for many months the toxic new water supply unleashed significant amounts of lead into the drinking water. Now a study out shows an estimated 29 California communities have lead poisoning levels surpassing the numbers in Flint. The city of Fresno, California, has three times the rate of lead poisoning. Poverty and poor housing are being cited by the exclusive Reuters report for those high rates of lead poisoning. And because children's brains are so vulnerable to any exposure at all to lead, an independent study of popular baby foods shows 20% of the prepared jarred foods for babies and toddlers had some level of lead in them. The highest concentration was in apple and grape juice, as well as sweet potatoes and carrots. The report issued by the Environmental Defense Fund examined data released by the EPA. According to the data, it seems prepared baby foods are the single biggest contributor to lead exposure in children. Even a few micrograms per day can cause permanent brain damage and attention deficit in children. And speaking of ADHD, a drug company, Shire, has been given FDA approval for a long-acting drug to treat attention deficit disorder in teens and adults. Shire, whose ADHD drugs Adderall and Vyvanse generated close to $2.4 billion in sales last year alone, plans to launch MyDayz. Recent data show up to 11% of American children are afflicted and more than half continue to suffer as adults. Both MyDayz and Adderall XR contain amphetamine, a stimulant that elevates levels of dopamine, a neurotransmitter associated with motivation, attention, and movement. Such drugs carry a risk of abuse, even fatal in rare cases. Non-stimulant ADHD treatments have fewer side effects but are typically less effective. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Garen Wintemute, director of the Violence Prevention Research Institute at the University of California, Davis, an ER physician and professor of emergency medicine. Dr. Wintemute is also a leading global researcher on analyzing gun violence from a public health perspective. He served as medical coordinator at the Nong Summit refugee camp in Cambodia. He earned his undergraduate degree at Yale, his master's in public health at Johns Hopkins, and earned his medical degree and did his residency at UC Davis. Dr. Wintemute, thank you for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thanks for having me.
You launched, after your ER experience, the Violence Protection Research Program at UC Davis back in the 1980s, and sort of kudos to you for being a pioneer. And I'm wondering if you could take our listeners back to the sort of the driving mission of the work that you do at the Violence Protection Research Program, and maybe any seminal moment or experience that brought you to spend a lifetime engaged in this work.
We, for some years, have used emergency departments and trauma services here in the U.S. to train the armed services combat surgical teams, because they can see battlefield trauma right here in the United States. Back in the 80s and early 90s, it was actually something of a hard sell that violence was a health problem and not a crime problem. And the best encapsulation of the argument I've ever heard came from David Satcher, a physician who had just taken over at CDC and was asked about this. And he said, look, if violence isn't a health problem, then why are all these people dying from it?
Right.
In my own case, the experience was that time in Cambodia that you mentioned. It was a very intensive experience in the power of violence to disrupt people's lives. Not long after I got home, realized I can do that work right here. And the other realization, the vast majority of people who die from gunshot wounds in the United States die where they're shot.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how fast the ambulance is. It doesn't matter how good the ER docs and the surgeons are. Those people are just dead. And for me and others, there came the recognition that if we as clinicians want to make the maximum inroad into the number of people who die from firearm violence, we need to prevent them from being shot in the first place.
Well, you know, Dr. Wintermute, I'm not sure our listeners would be very familiar with the Dickey Amendment, which Congress passed 20 years ago, which essentially barred the Centers for Disease Control from utilizing any government funds for research that might somehow support gun control legislation. But help our listeners understand, what was this Dickey Amendment and the impact it had on your research or the research of your colleagues? I understand that you've basically began to contribute your own personal funds to keep this vital work going. Tell us about that.
So in the early 1990s, we were facing a real epidemic of firearm violence. And the country did what we do best and should be very proud of. We committed funding to understanding the problem better. Congress was interested in doing something with the results of the research. It's sort of like the mobilizations that we've had for cancer and heart disease and motor vehicle injuries. We're doing it now for opioid abuse and the Zika virus.
Right.
The difference is that mobilization was choked off. There were and are interests in the United States who oppose changes in firearm policy. And I think they took the position that let's simply choke off the supply of the evidence that might make those changes possible. Jay Dickey was a congressman from Arkansas, describing himself as the point person for the National Rifle Association, carried an amendment that was adopted by Congress and that said that federal funds could not be used, quote, to advocate or promote gun control. Congress took from CDC's budget, this is the mid-1990s, took from CDC's budget the amount of money that they had been spending on firearm research and gave it back to them earmarked for another purpose. CDC overnight, within a few months, shut down their extramural funding program. We had a research program going in large part with their support, and CDC still does not fund research. Other federal agencies do. The National Institute of Justice, think NIH, but for criminal justice matters. And a few years ago, the National Institutes of Health launched, for the first time in their history, a program of funding for research on firearm violence. Compared to what's needed, it falls way, way short. The question that I have, as both a researcher and a clinician, is how many thousands of people are dead today who would be alive if that work had been allowed to continue, if we had been able to enact policies based on the answers to tough questions, when today we don't have those questions answered?
Well, if there are 34,000 gun-related deaths per year in this country, it's about 100 a day. I decided to do a controlled evaluation of the California Armed and Prohibited Person System, which seeks to prevent violence by recovering firearms from persons who may have purchased them legally but have since become prohibited persons. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about your findings?
We work very hard in the United States to prevent prohibited people, felons, people who've been convicted of domestic violence and so on, from purchasing firearms. But we do essentially nothing when the reverse set of circumstances applies. When someone purchases a firearm legally and then at some time later newly becomes a prohibited person. Here in California, an effort is being undertaken to address that gap. If a person has just had a prohibiting event occur, and if they show up in that archive of firearm transactions, there's obviously a real possibility that they still possess a firearm and are prohibited from doing that. What follows is a knock on the door, and they're taken on a temporary basis because those prohibitions might expire. What we know so far is that such a program is feasible. It can operate. It's been operating for a while now. Thousands of firearms have been recovered. No one's been hurt. Nothing bad has happened. What we need to let some time pass in order to determine is whether the program works in the sense of reducing risk of future violence on the part of people who are affected. And we're in the middle of that work right now.
Well, that sort of leads us to the research that you've done. You know, in primary care, we routinely screen patients for the prevalence of substance abuse. And we know that there's a corollary, particularly between alcohol and domestic violence. How did you analyze the connection between alcohol or substance abuse and gun violence, and what did you find?
There is a huge body of evidence establishing that alcohol abuse is a risk factor for future violence by itself, even when other risk factors are controlled for, specifically involving firearms. What there hasn't been is a study of whether alcohol abuse is a risk factor for future violence, specifically among people who own firearms. And we've just actually finished one study in this area. And what we learned is that firearm owners are just like everybody else, that even when you control for other risk factors for violence in the future, such as age and sex and a past history of violence, alcohol abuse is a substantial and independent risk factor for future violence involving firearms, major violent crimes like homicide and rape and robbery and aggravated assault. The bottom line is that we're learning that firearm owners aren't different. They're just like the rest of us when it comes to the relationship between alcohol and future violence.
We're speaking today with Dr. Garen Wintemute, Director of the Violence Prevention Research Institute at the University of California, Davis. Dr. Wintemute, in the quest to understand the recent spate of mass shootings that have occurred around the country, the discussion often turns to the link between mental illness and gun violence. And what has your research revealed about the role mental illness that are more likely to lead to gun violence?
Well, no more than 4 to 5% of interpersonal violence can be directly attributed to serious mental illness by itself. There are certain points in the history of a mental illness when risk is increased. One is when that mental illness is first diagnosed. Another is at times of acute exacerbation, when there's been a mental health emergency. And I want to draw a parallel here between mental illness and other chronic illnesses. Public mass shootings are a very, very small part of the overall problem of firearm violence in the United States. Well under 1% of fatalities from firearm violence in the United States come from mass shootings.
Well, one of the problems is just the unbelievable proliferation of weapon ownership in this country. Then I understand that you have looked at the whole area of gun shows and gone to gun shows where private gun sales are a common occurrence. Can you talk about this less regulated marketplace?
We have fewer than 5% of the people on the planet. We have more than 40% of firearms in civilian hands. We have a set of policies that make the widest possible array of firearms available to the widest possible array of people for use. One such federal policy established what amount to two separate systems of commerce in firearms. If I buy a gun from a licensed retailer, I have to show my ID and fill out a very lengthy form and undergo a background check. And the retailer has to keep a permanent record of the sale, which means I can be linked to the gun. But I can buy a gun from a private party, and there's no paperwork, there's no background check, there's no waiting period. It's gun, cash, and a handshake. And I, the buyer, get to choose which system I'm going to use. If I'm acquiring that gun with criminal intent and don't want anybody to know about it, that private party purchase is the only option for me. Nearly 40% of all firearm acquisitions in the United States occur through that unregulated, don't ask, don't tell system. And that proportion doubles from 40% to more than 80% if the firearm is being acquired with criminal intent.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've said a person can have a misdemeanor rap sheet as long as an arm and still be able to purchase a gun legally. Your research has shown that the most telling factor in predicting potential gun violence is a person's prevalence of petty crimes and misdemeanor convictions. So tell our listeners what your data has shown you about the connections between lax gun laws and the incident of gun violence.
So it is a myth that violent criminals cannot buy guns legally. A person under federal law can be convicted of any number of violent misdemeanors. Assault and battery is a good example. here in California, violent misdemeanants are not allowed to purchase firearms. And we evaluated that change in policy and found that it was quite effective. It reduced the risk of future violence in that population by 25 to 30%. We've got 50 laboratories in the United States conducting experiments in firearm policy, and all these experiments are being conducted, and there are very few people available to see what the results are.
Dr. Wintermute, with so many guns in circulation, curtailing the influence of the NRA isn't likely to happen anytime soon. Certainly a very vocal contingent in Congress, willing to hold a 24-hour sit-in, demanding a more rational approach to gun policies. But I'd like to ask you, what is your recommendation for the best way forward on getting the proper emphasis on the public health threat of gun violence?
One is to get better evidence. At a time when policy reform might be in the offing, we need the best available evidence to guide those reforms. Here in California, the legislature authorized, and the University of California is probably about to establish, a firearm violence research center. That's a big problem in California as it is nationally. Congress hasn't stepped up. Fair enough. California will do its part. That measure was legislation that was considered by the state legislature. And Jay Dickey wrote a very strong letter in support of that bill to establish a research center. Jay Dickey has had a change of heart and has recognized that his language, which spoke only to advocacy, had been used to suppress research, and he's come to see that as wrong. And it was very heartening to get his support. I think that whatever the outcome of the election in November, there's going to be more support for research on this obvious, large, and pressing problem. I am optimistic. Having lived through the last three decades of this, I know the following to be true: that the conversation has simply not stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Since December of 2012, people have been talking without end and increasingly about how big a problem this is and how we need to do more about it. New people are signing up to help with the research effort, to help with the advocacy effort, if that's where their skill set lies. I think we are not far away from seeing substantial change for the better.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Garen Wintermute, director of the Violence Prevention Research Institute at the University of California at Davis. You can learn more about his work by going to ucdavis.edu/VPRP. Dr. Wintermute, thank you so much for the very important work that you are doing and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Sure. Thanks very much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Opponents of the Republican House healthcare bill are claiming its provisions on pre-existing conditions reach further than they actually do. For instance, a TV ad from AARP says, quote, insurers can charge thousands more for pre-existing conditions under the bill. They can, but that would happen only in states that obtained a waiver and only for the relative few who buy policies on the individual marketplace and have a lapse in insurance coverage. The House passed the American Health Care Act on May 4th, and it is now under consideration by the Senate. The ad shows an accountant telling a man and a woman who both say they're over 50 years old that insurance companies can charge them five times more because of their age. Under the Republican bill, insurers can charge older people five times more for premiums than younger people for insurance on the individual market. Insurers could even charge more than that under waivers that states could get under the bill. The Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, limits insurers to charging three times as much to older policyholders. But then the accountant in the ad tells the couple that insurers can charge thousands more for pre-existing conditions. The couple in the ad would have to meet several criteria for that to happen. Under the House Republican bill, insurers cannot set premiums based on health status. That's the case under the Affordable Care Act, too. However, states can get a federal waiver to allow insurers to price policies on the individual market based on health status in some cases. Under the waiver, insurers could charge more for pre-existing conditions if an individual hadn't maintained continuous coverage. That higher premium can be charged for 1 year, and then, provided there wasn't another 63-day lapse in coverage, the policyholder would get a new premium that wasn't based on health status. The Kaiser Family Foundation estimates 7% of the population had insurance on the individual market in 2015, and AARP estimated this year that 6 million people aged 50 to 64 got individual market insurance. Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto also wrongly claimed that more than 1.2 million people with pre-existing conditions in her state of Nevada, quote, would be denied coverage or face exorbitant, unaffordable premiums. The bill doesn't allow insurers to deny coverage, and her figure is a high-end estimate for all Nevadans with some pre-existing condition. 7% of Nevadans get coverage through that market, while 46% of the state's population has employer-sponsored coverage. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Of the roughly 4 million women who give birth annually in the United States, a quarter of them retain at least 10 pounds gained during their pregnancy. And these women are also more likely to add weight during the first postpartum year. Those numbers go up significantly for African American, Hispanic, and low-income women.
So I was interested in finding a way to help women during this time, because regardless of how much a woman gains during pregnancy, weight gain during this period is a kind of independent risk factor, we call it.
California Polytechnic Institute researcher Dr. Suzanne Phelan wondered if a customized intervention designed around the Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women as well as the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program might help such women shed postpartum weight.
You see about 30% dropout, and it's no surprise because women during the postpartum period, they're busy with their baby, they've got this erratic, unpredictable schedule. So our team got together and we thought, you know, let's try something online.
Her team designed a website with features such as weekly lessons, a web diary, instructional videos, computerized feedback, text messages, and monthly face-to-face groups at the WIC clinics. 12 clinics were randomized to the WIC program, or the standard care group, or the WIC program plus, the 12-month primarily internet-based weight loss program.
Yeah, so the intervention targeted healthy eating and physical activity and then behavioral strategies. And so we provided some menu plans online that would promote modest weight loss, and we gave them calorie goals dependent on if they were breastfeeding or not. And we also gave them physical activity goals, which were 30 minutes most days of the week. And we gave behavioral tools too, including self-monitoring, daily recording of their food intake.
And the results were significant. More women with the internet intervention, 57%, lost weight than the WIC participants alone.
Not only that, we got weight loss, and we got a greater proportion of women who lost the 5% and 10% of their body weight, which we know are clinically significant, and they reduced their waist circumference, which is a health indicator for long-term health risk. But the women retain weight differentially around the waist in the postpartum period. So it was exciting that we prevented that and even reduced waist circumference.
The loss translates into a statistically lower risk of later weight gain and the long-term risk for related health issues such as diabetes and heart disease that accompany it.
But the other key finding is we got a greater percentage of women return to their pre-pregnancy weight. The fact that we got them back to their pre-pregnancy weight is really exciting, because if you retain weight above pre-pregnancy, that's the risk factor for long-term health problems.
A low-cost, guided online nutrition and weight loss support program designed for women receiving SNAP and WIC benefits for postpartum nutrition, empowering them with additional tools to lose that nagging baby weight so many women struggle with, and yielding a greater weight loss success and healthier outcomes. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.